Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Ann Ball, Kelly Jean Kelly, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Brian Lynn.
Researchers say they have discovered a plant in Canada that not only eats insects, but also feeds on at least one amphibious creature. The discovery was recently reported in a study by a research team from Canada's University of Guelph in Ontario. The study was published in the journal Ecology. The research involved pitcher plants in Ontario's Algonquin Provincial Park. The plants, which take many shapes and sizes and have colorful designs, grow in wetlands across Canada. A pitcher plant's leaves usually form a tall, narrow pocket that can hold liquid. Insects and spiders that enter the pocket often become trapped, and the pitcher plant then feeds on their bodies. Pitcher plants are often found in bogs, soft, extremely wet areas. The plants are known for feeding on small organisms, such as insects and spiders, that get caught in the trap. But the researchers made a surprising discovery. The pitcher plants were also feeding on young salamanders. A salamander is a lizard-like amphibian. The research team said it believes this is the first time any North American pitcher plants have been observed feeding on anything besides insects or spiders. In the summer of 2017, then University of Guelph student Teske Baldwin found a salamander trapped inside a pitcher plant while doing field work in the provincial park. One of the biggest surprises was that the discovery did not happen earlier, the researcher said. Alex Smith is a biology professor at the University of Guelph and co-writer of the study. He told Canada's CTV News the research station near the bog where the pitcher plants were observed has been there for 70 years. So the surprise was that we discovered such a new case of plants eating vertebrates involving such a well-known species in such a well-known space, Smith said. During visits to a single area of the park in fall of 2018, the research team found almost one in five pitcher plants contained young salamanders. The amphibians were each about as long as a human finger. Several plants contained more than one captured salamander. Some of the trapped salamanders died within 3 days, while others lived for up to 19 days, the study found. The researchers said they do not know what killed the salamanders. They could have died from proteins produced by the pitcher plants that are held in liquid inside the leaves. This liquid mixture is designed to break down organisms trapped in the plants to aid the feeding process. The researchers suggested other possible causes for the salamander deaths could have included heat, starvation, or infections. Organisms living in the pitcher may also help break down the salamanders' bodies. The study found that there are also several possible reasons the young salamanders are drawn to the plants in the first place. One is that they fall into the plant pockets accidentally. They also could go in to find a place to hide or to feed on insects or spiders already trapped there. The researchers say pitcher plants clearly get a lot more nutrients from salamanders than from insects and spiders. So there is no reason to think that the plants will not continue feeding on them. Meat-eating pitcher plants have been known since the 18th century, the University of Guelph says. One species discovered 10 years ago in Asia feeds mostly on insects and spiders, but sometimes captures small birds and mice. Alex Smith said the discovery opens some new questions that future research might help explain. Are salamanders an important feeding source for pitcher plants? Are the plants important predators of the amphibians? Might the salamanders compete with plants for insect food? The university said the discovery area could even be called the Little Bog of Horrors, after a Broadway musical and film that includes a giant plant that likes to eat people. I'm Brian Lynn.
Vietnam has placed tariffs on some goods from China. Vietnam accuses China of using its country to avoid similar American tariffs on Chinese goods exported to the United States. Vietnam's temporary anti-dumping tax of 2.46% to 35.58% will affect several aluminum products that come from China. The tax will be in place for 120 days. Shippers based in China were sending products meant for the United States to Vietnam first because it did not demand tariffs. Manufacturers in Vietnam were marking these products as made in Vietnam, then shipping them to the U.S. SSI Research is a financial market research company based in Hanoi, Vietnam's capital. It called the tariffs a very bold move for Vietnam. It also praised the anti-dumping tariffs as an efficient answer from the Vietnamese side to U.S. tariffs to be placed on aluminum products exported from Vietnam but manufactured in China. Chinese exports of partly finished aluminum products doubled last year to 62 tons as a U.S.-Chinese trade dispute broke out. Of that amount, SSI Research said, significant quantity is believed to be shipped from China to avoid anti-dumping and tariffs. Other Asian countries, Indonesia and Malaysia, for example, have ordered their own tariffs on Chinese steel imports. Countries in the area are trying to develop their own steel or aluminum industries, but Chinese exporters can sell for less than others because of the size of their production and supply. Vietnam absorbs a large share of the Chinese aluminum because it shares a land border and low manufacturing costs, said Song Sung Woon with CIMB in Singapore. Manufacturing drives the Vietnamese economy, helping it grow at 6 to 7% a year. Economists believe the big increase in imports from China had hurt Vietnam's own aluminum industry and risked sharper U.S. government examination. I do see the Vietnamese trying to be tough on transshipments, said Frederick Burke, a lawyer in Ho Chi Minh City with the international law firm Baker McKenzie. Burke said the Vietnamese see the Chinese action as criminal. He added, it's ruining their reputation and they get no benefit out of it. Vietnam, like China, also runs a trade surplus with the United States. The imbalance is what led to the Chinese-American trade dispute that is now in its second year. We certainly can see that the sweeping power of President Trump can be fairly extensive, Song said. As a result, he said, the Vietnamese are less interested in angering the Americans than the Chinese. I'm Ann Ball.
A recent public opinion survey found that Americans have concerns about the age of presidential candidates. The survey is connected to the Williams Institute at UCLA. It found that voters are more likely to reject a candidate over 70 years old than one who is homosexual. The information comes as Americans prepare for the 2020 presidential election. On Election Day next November, Senator Bernie Sanders would be 79, former Vice President Joe Biden, 77, President Donald Trump, 74, and Senator Elizabeth Warren, 71. The two youngest candidates are Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who are both in their 30s. Buttigieg is also one of the first openly gay presidential candidates from a major party. The survey was meant to find out Americans' opinions about a homosexual presidential candidate. A public opinion survey in 2007 found that Americans were more likely to support a candidate in his or her 70s than one who was homosexual. But this year, a number of national surveys showed the opposite. The recent UCLA survey found that nearly half of adults in the U.S. would be much or somewhat less likely to support a presidential candidate older than 70. In contrast, about one-third said they would be less likely to vote for someone who is gay. The survey measured the public's general acceptance of people from different groups. It did not ask about voters' support for individual candidates. Kyle Condict is a political observer at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. Condict noted that people's answers in a survey can be different from what they decide on Election Day. People might say they want a younger candidate, Kondik observed. But age may not be the only issue that informs their vote. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember.
Three days from now, after half a century in the service of our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office as, in traditional and solemn ceremony, the authority of the presidency is vested in my successor. This evening, I come to you with a message of leave-taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen.
Dwight Eisenhower was elected president in 1952. The following year, the Korean War ended with an armistice, a ceasefire agreement. During his presidency, Eisenhower began a tradition of meetings between the leaders of the United States and the Soviet Union. He met with Soviet leaders Nikolai Bulganin and Nikita Khrushchev. These meetings may have helped reduce the threat of a nuclear war between the two countries during the Cold War. By 1960, Eisenhower had served two terms. The Constitution was changed to prevent presidents from being elected more than twice after Franklin Roosevelt won four times.
We now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. Three of these involved our own country. Despite these holocausts, America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interests of world peace and human betterment. Throughout America's corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
At the end of Eisenhower's first term, he was still very popular. He had suffered a heart attack, but the Republican president felt strong enough to campaign again in 1956. His Democratic Party opponent was Adlai Stevenson. They had been the candidates in the presidential election 4 years earlier. This time, Eisenhower won almost 10 million more votes than Stevenson, an even bigger victory than in 1952. Eisenhower's second term, however, presented problems. The Soviet Union launched the Space Age by putting the first satellite into orbit around Earth. Fidel Castro established a communist government in Cuba. Many white Americans were fighting the Supreme Court's decision to end racial separation in schools. And the American economy suffered a recession. Eisenhower's popularity dropped during his second term. This would make it difficult for the Republican Party's next candidate for president. The delegates who attended the presidential nominating convention in the summer of 1960 feared that their party would lose the election in November. They had to find the strongest candidate possible. Many believed that Richard Nixon was the strongest. Nixon had been a senator and a member of the House of Representatives. He had been Eisenhower's vice president for 8 years. When Eisenhower suffered several serious illnesses, Nixon had a chance to show his abilities to lead the nation. He showed great strength while facing an angry crowd during a trip to South America. He also gained support when he defended the United States to Khrushchev during a trip to the Soviet Union. Nixon's closest opponent for the Republican nomination was Nelson Rockefeller. Rockefeller was the governor of New York State. He came from one of the richest families in America. Richard Nixon easily won the support of the party. The delegates nominated him on the first vote. He accepted the nomination, and he called for new efforts for peace and freedom around the world. The race for the Democratic nomination was much more difficult. The Democratic Party thought it would have no problem winning the presidential election. Many candidates entered the race for the nomination. One was Senator Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota. Another was Senator John Kennedy of Massachusetts. Humphrey had been elected to the Senate 3 times. He was a strong activist for civil rights and peace. Kennedy was a Navy hero in World War II. He was handsome and only 43 years old. He was also Roman Catholic. No Catholic had ever been elected president of the United States. Kennedy and Humphrey began to compete in state primary elections, the first step in the nominating process. Kennedy won an important primary in Wisconsin, but voters in Protestant areas of that state did not support him. The question then became, could he win in another state, West Virginia? Most of the voters in that state were Protestant. On the last night of the primary campaign in West Virginia, Kennedy spoke about his religion. He said, "The President of the United States promises to defend the Constitution. And that," he said, "includes the separation of the government from any religion or church." Kennedy won a big victory in West Virginia. He then went on to win many votes in other primaries. He received the nomination on the first vote at the Democratic Convention. In his acceptance speech, he said he would ask Americans to help their country and sacrifice for their country. After the party conventions, the two candidates, Kennedy and Nixon, began to campaign around the country. Nixon charged that Kennedy was too young to be president. He said Kennedy did not know enough about governing. Kennedy attacked the Republican record of the past 8 years. He said President Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon had not done enough to bring progress to the nation. Protestant groups expressed concerns about Kennedy's religion. They wondered if he would be influenced by the Pope. They wondered if the leader of the Roman Catholic Church would try to make policy for the United States. Kennedy answered by repeating his strong support for the constitutional separation of church and state. Public opinion surveys showed the election campaign to be very close. Then the candidates agreed to hold four debates on television. In the first debate, the candidates showed they did not differ too widely on major issues. Kennedy appeared calm and sure, but Nixon did not feel well. He appeared thin and tired. Many people who had not considered voting for Kennedy now began to change their minds. To them, he looked more presidential. Most people seemed to feel that Kennedy won the first debate. Nixon probably won the second one. And both men did about the same in the last two. In the fourth debate, they expressed widely different opinions about whether the United States was making progress. Kennedy believed there had been little progress under Eisenhower and Nixon.
Franklin Roosevelt said in 1936 that that generation of Americans had a rendezvous with destiny. I believe in 1960 and 61 and 2 and 3, we have a rendezvous with destiny. And I believe it incumbent upon us to be the defenders of the United States and the defenders of freedom. And to do that, we must give this country leadership and we must get America moving again.
Nixon disagreed. He believed the United States had not been standing still, but there was more to be done.
It is essential, with the conflict that we have around the world, that we not just hold our own, that we not keep just freedom for ourselves. It is essential that we extend freedom, extend it to all the world. And this means more than what we've been doing. It means keeping America even stronger militarily than she is. It means seeing that our economy moves forward even faster than it has. It means making more progress in civil rights than we have, so that we can be a splendid example for all the world to see.
Another issue in the 1960 presidential debates was the Chinese attack on the islands of Quemoy and Matsu in the Taiwan Strait. And another was how to deal with Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev. After the debates, the presidential candidates campaigned around the country again. Nixon proposed that if he were elected, he would travel to Eastern Europe and meet with Khrushchev. Kennedy proposed the Peace Corps, a program to send Americans to developing countries to provide technical aid and other help. On Election Day in November, the voters chose John Kennedy as their 35th president. His victory, however, was a close one. Almost 69 million people voted. Kennedy won by fewer than 120,000 votes.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.